Ready to go, 7 o'clock, it's the hour. Welcome everybody, a reminder that this is being recorded. Is there any public comment on non-agenda items? Okay, hearing none, I think what I'm gonna first do is read a letter of commendation we have for Brian Nicolai, our assistant chief, regarding his activities in the Bridger Foothill fires that we just recently, like a month or two ago, authorized you to do. Yeah. And then you were a rock star on TV and all that kind of stuff. So I'm just going to read this and sign it, and I'm sure all the trustees will share in the celebration of Brian's work. Dear Chief Nicolai, the Highlight Fire District Board of Trustees would like to recognize your outstanding performance and service that you provided to the community during the Bridger Foothills fire. As incident commander for the first 3 days of this large and devastating fire, you provided exceptional leadership in both operations planning and logistics. The Bridger Foothills fire was a rapidly expanding and explosive event that surprised many seasoned fire suppression agencies with its aggressive behavior. As incident commander, you remained calm and thoughtful in your management of the fire suppression resources, law enforcement officers performing evacuation of residents, and the state and federal agencies who responded to assist with the fire. After your 3 days as incident commander, you successfully transitioned management of the fire to a national Type 1 incident management team. The board is very proud of you and your actions, and we appreciate and thank you for your dedication to the safety of Gallatin County residents. Sincerely, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just a reminder that when we're taking public comment tonight, which we're always happy to do, if you come up to, please come up to the dais and use the speaker, or microphone, just click it on and then get close to it like I am here. It makes it easier for folks who are calling in on the line to hear anything. And remove your mask when you're up there. And of course, give us your name, rank, and serial number. Moving on to the consent agenda. Are there any items any board member would like pulled from the consent agenda? Any public comment on the consent agenda? Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Call the roll, Cheryl.
JJ?
Aye.
Oh, it's on here. Nick?
Aye.
Justin?
Aye.
Pete?
Yes. There you go, Nick. Okay. Discussion and decision reappropriation of SCBA's self-contained breathing apparatus. That sounds like you, Chief.
Correct. As the board is well aware, we replaced all of our SCBAs with MSA models. They are in service and our firefighters have been trained on them. Given the nature of our old packs, we would like the board's approval to solicit fire departments in states who have much smaller budgets than we do. To give those SCBAs to them if they need them. We've done that before with other equipment, such as extrication tools. Typically, we will advertise them on the Montana State Fire School's little newsletter. It's called the Latest, and it comes out 5 days a week, and we can put on there that we have packs that the departments can have.
Board discussion. Nick?
Yes, just out of curiosity, what's the value approximately? What does that gift amount to?
I really couldn't give you a number of what we could potentially sell them for. They no longer meet current NFPA standards, so I would have to guess that the value is low, but I cannot tell you an exact number. Now, that being said, everything we have has a value. I've always believed throughout my career that there are so many small departments in the state operating off $10,000 annual budgets, and I think it's a very responsible and community-driven concept to pass that on to other departments to help them out.
JJ?
Just as a perspective piece, Mr. Schrager and I and a few others in the room will remember receiving hand-me-downs from other departments at this department in the early 80s and 70s. So I think that's reasonable to pay it back.
Nick? I was just going to remark that how excited we were when we had turnouts.
Yep.
That were used. I mean, they were turnouts. It was better than overalls.
Yeah, my thinking on this is exactly in line with Jason's. We've done this numerous times over my service on the board, and I think it's just a good thing to do for our emergency services community. Any public comment on this item? Any more board discussion? Okay, can I have a motion? Is that what we're looking for here?
I make a motion that we... find another department that's in need and
move that gear on.
Move the gear on.
Second.
Oh, second. I thought you seconded.
I was looking for a second.
Oh, you have a second.
Any public comment on the motion? Okay, Cheryl?
JJ, have a vote?
Yes.
Nick?
Yes.
Justin?
Yes.
Pete?
Yes. Okay, ambulance transport. This is an ongoing discussion, and I think I'm just really pleased with how this is going. There's been some interest generated by members of our community, which I think is just fantastic, and lots of questions generated. Steve, I just want to thank you for stepping up and helping out with this. Really appreciate it. Let me just tell you my sense of how this is going. I would like, as we've talked about, to have in October a couple of, you know, if it weren't COVID times, they'd be kind of like open houses, like you would go to a Forest Service thing where there were different stations around the department, and we just had some time for people to come in and see material, perhaps look at all these FAQs that the list is expanding. And then have a presentation. And I'm not particularly hung up on that format, but I think we need to get, before we leave tonight, on the calendar two information sessions, if you will. We'll call them special meetings or whatever we need to make it proper, but where we're just presenting information and then hearing from the public on this particular issue. We have emails from Wayne Giff and Don Murdoch and Mr. Waistcoat, and those will just be included in the public record. Cheryl had them printed out here. You guys have all seen them. They were all sent to us. We got them just before the meeting here. So again, I think this is a process that's going along exactly as it should. Lots of information being gathered. Members of the public having questions about that, and we'll make sure that we get all those questions answered. So I think with that preamble, we'll turn it over to Jason to give us an update on where we are, and then we'll have a bunch of public comment and board discussion.
Sure. I sent to all the board members the kind of progress report and the question and answer section that I put together for everyone, and I don't know that I need to go over that on each item. If there are questions, please let me know. What I would like to ask is for Mr. Steve White to come up and talk a little bit about the spreadsheet that he developed, because that's probably maybe the point that isn't as self-explanatory as a question and answer piece. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks for, is this on?
Thanks for the advance notice of asking me. Let's get him to come to the meeting and then we'll tell him. Steve White, citizen and member of the ambulance subcommittee for the Highlander Fire District. The reason this spreadsheet exists was simply because of me keeping asking what kind of business plan or model are we looking at? What are the numbers? I want to know the numbers. I don't want to just hear that it's not going to cost a lot because we can just get an ambulance and we have EMTs that are qualified to run it. I just wanted to know the numbers, and I'm a proponent of having it separate from the districts and not letting the district fund it through the general fund, but it would try to stand on its own. So what I did was I just list, as we had our meeting, it was a great meeting, and it just says Jason talked about some of the expenses, JJ talked about some of the expenses. And you know, everybody around the table, we were all talking about the things we were going to do, what could come up. All I did was just, I sat there with my laptop. I have it here tonight, and I just put together a spreadsheet on the fly. This is a refined version of it. But basically, I said, what are the expenses and what's the revenue that could be generated? And what kind of revenue could we generate? So for expenses, it's minimal. You know, okay, for each call, how much money do you spend on supplies? These would be transports. It's $25 a call. And how much fuel would you use? Well, you know, 50 cents, figuring out how many miles per gallon you're going to get, you know, you're going to get, you know, like 18 miles a gallon or something, maybe $3 in fuel. We don't know. It could be a short call, a long call, we don't know. But all of these numbers can be changed. That's the cool thing about a spreadsheet. Then there was some discussion of maybe a stipend for the EMTs, $50 per EMT for each call. So that would be a total of $100. Then as we talked about this, I kind of promoted the idea of, you know, this should be standing on its own. So if you need an ambulance in the future, you should have a replacement fund, or some sort of capital replacement fund. So let's put that in there as an expense. So we start pulling some money out and setting it aside in some sort of an escrow account or something for a future replacement. So we just picked that it was going to be $12,000 a year. So it's not per call, it's just a fixed amount. So if you look at the spreadsheet, it's $12,000 each year, no matter how many calls there are. The original, that night, we talked about 100 calls in a year. So I expanded the spreadsheet to go to 150 calls a year and 200 calls a year. So I, myself, just took the formulas and moved them over to some new columns. Then I'm gonna go down to the revenue and said, okay, we have two different types of calls, and the board still hasn't decided how they're gonna charge, but we just picked some numbers. Okay, if you are a person that is inside the fire district and you're paying for this district on your tax bill, then you would get a lesser amount charged for your transport. We picked $500. You know, it could be $100, could be $1,000, but we said $500 per call. And then if you're not in the district and you were just, you know, you lived across the line, or you're from, you know, another state, then it would be a compatible charge of $2,000 a call. Could be $2,500 a call. We threw $2,000 in there. And so then it was simply a matter of multiplying 100 calls a year times many of those numbers. So the beauty is with a spreadsheet, you can just change things. So if you see a line there that says percentage of calls that are local. Okay, so of the 100 calls for a year, 60 of them, 60% would be local, and 40% would be outside the district. And so it was using that 60%, figuring out how many calls would be from district people and non-district people. So that first column is $30,000 would be charged to locals, and $60,000 would be charged to out-of-district people. So for the year, for 100 calls, it's $110,000 would be generated. So down below is a billing revenue. So we figured there's a delinquency, and that's pretty common of people not paying their bills. So we just picked 30%. I've now got the spreadsheet fixed. You don't have it on yours, but I got it fixed so you can change that. And I've actually done one with 40% delinquency. So again, if there's 30% delinquency on $110,000, then that's $33,000 that we would probably not collect. So 70% are paid, which is $77,000. And then to process that, we would pay the billing company 8%. And I think these numbers are right here. It's 8% of $110,000. So our cost for processing the billing, and I don't know if that includes collection or what, but it would be 8% of $110,000, which is $6,000. And then you subtract the costs that were from above, which is the total cost on that first bunch of numbers. And so that gives you, for 100 calls a year, $46,000. And then if it's 150 calls a year, $75,000 net, and 200 calls a year, $104,000. And then just to give you some comparative numbers, I made some modifications to the spreadsheet to give some different ideas. So I said if half the calls are local and half are non-local, what does that do to the revenue? And at first, 100 calls a year, the revenue would jump up to $55,700. And 150 calls would be $89,555. And if you have 200 calls a year, the net revenue would be $123,400. And if the percentage of calls for, and we don't know these numbers, but if I said, okay, what if the percentage of calls are local that are, it goes up to 70%. So 70% of are in district, 30% out of district, then you're going to make less on your calls. And so the net would go for 100 calls a year, go down 36,380. And for 150 calls, 60,570. And 200 calls, 84,760. Because you're not making as much, because now you've got 70% of the calls are getting $500 charged for each call. Then, this is an additional thing, as I upped the delinquency rate from 30% to 40%. And what that did, that reduced your 100 calls for the year by $11,000. Because now you've got $44,000 in delinquency instead of $33,000 for 100 calls. So the net then goes to basically $36,000. And then for 150 calls, just short of $60,000. And 200 calls, $83,000. These are all projections, and that's all I did. That was all I was tasked to do. And I just thought it was value in coming up with some numbers. Now, some things I might help preface that I think that, you know, the thing that needs to be done is to analyze somehow, I don't know, through 911 or whatever, the dispatch records, you know, what percentage could you figure out would be local and out of the district, because that makes a significant difference. And just maybe you could say, okay, if you change that to $2,000 from $2,000 for out of district to $2,500, which is probably an appropriate number because ambulances aren't cheap, then the numbers go up. But saying all of this, the numbers that you see on the spreadsheet that you're looking at, if you pay one EMT, if you go from volunteer to paid, it's out the door. Because if you pay one EMT, you know, a professional EMT, I would assume, I guess they're being paid just, you know, because not just when they make a call, but if they're being paid, like each of them being paid $40,000 a year, and then you get rid of that stipend line for sure. But that $46,000 now will turn into a negative of $34,000. And I don't think you can make it up. Maybe you can make it up almost with 200 calls. Because at 200 calls, you have 104,000. So maybe after paying two EMTs, you could put back, you'd end up with $20,000 left over. But we were talking about, I think 100 calls is an appropriate number for the stage. So these are the numbers for volunteers manning the program. But if it ever gets to the point where you need to go outside of volunteers, and I appreciate the volunteers being part of it, because that's the only way it's going to work. So I'm sorry if it seems limited. If we tried to make the numbers, I'm really into trying to analyze ahead of time before you jump into the deep end of the pool to make sure that, you know, if you can't swim, get your air flippers on, that you need to know kind of ahead of time what to expect. And with, as I said before, all that said, I still think it should be a separate cost center for the district, and so that the district is not going to, it's just not going to be pushed into this bigger pot of money, and you lose track of, you know, all of a sudden the taxpayers out there expecting fire service are going to be subsidizing the ambulance service, and I think that goes against the spirit of the district. So questions about any of my numbers?
Yeah,
Yeah, we'll have more discussion and lots of public comment. Any board members have a question to start with?
You know, I brought my laptop if you want to make some, say, well, you know, in your discussion, say, well, what if we, you know, we're 60% delinquency or something like that. I mean, I can rattle off some bottom line numbers.
That's fine. And for my colleagues up here on the table, just stick your hand up and I'll make sure to recognize you. A couple observations, Steve. One, I think the spreadsheet is just a starting point.
Sure.
And obviously we refined it, so thank you for getting this. It provides some boundaries things. A couple questions I had. Can we determine the actual number of transport cases, like in CY19, that we might have done? You guys picked 100, 150, and 200. I mean, if it were 5, that would seriously affect our calculations.
Your question was the question we batted around back and forth.
Yeah. So, Pete, the problem is that our current software program that we use to track all of our calls does not track transports, because we don't do transports.
Right.
And they certainly wouldn't track how many people were transported from a single call. I tried to get information through 911, but they admitted that what they provided to me through their CAD system was completely unreliable and a shot in the dark.
Yeah.
So that is the one issue, is this is one that we have to estimate. We just don't have a way of going back and figuring out exactly how many people throughout our 500 some odd calls in FY19 were actually transported to the hospital. We know how many EMS calls we went to.
Yeah.
But we also go to car accidents.
Sure.
That end up having transports. We have fires that end up having transports.
Right.
And we just don't have a way to accurately.
So just trying to get inside your head, with the way I would have approached it, it sounds like you took the number of EMS calls and you said, plus MVAs and all that kind of stuff, there's a certain percentage of people that would have been transported out of those particular calls, and that's how you got to this.
Yeah, roughly half of our calls are EMS calls.
Right, right.
And so that's 250. And then you add some motor vehicle accidents in there, and you're probably sitting around 300 calls. And I was guessing half of those would end up, and these are all incredibly. And that's what I wanted to point out to the board. These numbers that Steve has put together are incredibly conservative, pessimistic numbers. I mean, just like the automatic $12,000 contribution to capital reserve that is being demonstrated each year. I mean, that takes a big chunk out of what would be the revenue of it. But again, we're trying to be, in this committee, is pessimistic and conservative with these numbers, not pie in the sky.
The beauty about what we discussed that night was, if you see this $12,000 sitting here, it's being paid for by the ambulance service revenue. That's $12,000 that's going into capital reserve that isn't being paid for by Highline Fire.
No, I get that. I get that.
I mean, that's a big deal.
Totally get that. That is a big deal.
It's the standing on its own.
Yeah. I mean, we're not talking about smoke and mirrors and rock.
Yeah.
Hey, Paul, we're really taking and saying, hey, we want to capital replace this, so we're not going to rely upon it Highline to raise that money.
Right, so it's not coming out of this thing right here. That's exactly, no, that's really good. The reason I asked that question is Wayne Gibson, I thought a whole, let's see, like 9 questions, some of which were really good, and he's essentially trying to get to that number. Like, how do you come down to the number of runs? So I just wanted the public to understand,
right,
you know, the variables that we're using behind those numbers.
You know, and one more thing that he brought up in his email that I think is very important to differentiate is when Steve is discussing this, you know, in district versus out of district. I believe that email that he perceived that meant we were responding out of our district, and that's not what we're referring to. We're responding in our district. It's just the people that we transport don't live in the district,
sure.
And that's very common. All the traffic on 19th, Huffine, Cottonwood, so many of those people just don't. They're not
sure,
resident
they're going
taxpayers
to
in our
tourists
district.
Going to Yellowstone or yeah. Kansas or whatever.
Lost.
Other board members have questions.
Yeah,
Nick.
Yeah, just along on this transport in district and out, what are the costs to the staff for tracking these people You're saying we have a billing service, but the billing service has to be told, or how do they know that Joe is going to be charged $2,000 because he's not a highlight member, and Nick is going to be charged $500 because he is? How, there's a real cost to that, and I think we're, somebody's got to do it.
Okay, every time a transport is performed, the hospital gives a face sheet, is what they refer to it as, which has all the patient's demographics on it. And that face sheet is designed for billing purposes. And that face sheet has that person's address on it. It's very simple for us as we process a patient care report to know whether that address is within our district and with that in, or outside of our district. So that's a very easy, it's a great question, very easy task to perform. It literally takes 30 seconds to look up an address and know whether that's in our district or out of our district.
More board discussion.
I guess I have another question. And I believe I think Jason knows, and several people know that I'm dumb as a post, so I've spent a long time trying to get my mind around what I think. This is a very complex thing, and everybody's been very helpful, and I appreciate all their patience with my questions. But as I look at this, add up the number on the cost of per call, I think that's not a realistic number. I think that the true cost of that expense of that call has to include for that unit the heat, lights, insurance, maintenance, staff maintenance, the ambulance for the purposes of this transport. In other words, I think this is, in my mind, and maybe somebody can help me understand differently, but I think that this is not anywhere as close to the real cost of what it is to operate that ambulance on a per call basis. That's what I...
Steve, did you guys talk about that? I mean, basically, Nick, you're trying to, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do, to sort of amortize the cost of the
service. My questions, Mr. Chair, that night were exactly Nick's. I kept wanting to add more money into the cost because it didn't seem like it should be that low. But tremendous amount of percentage of the costs are taken care of by volunteers. That's what I'm saying. If you take away the volunteers, put pay people in there so the volunteers, and things are going to change. But I don't know what those other costs are. Even if you add heat and lights, or maybe the heat, maybe if the ambulance is plugged in during the winter time or something to prepare for use, if you figure out what those heating costs are, the electricity costs for the month, I mean, I know what it costs me to plug my car in continually. It's the best deal on the planet. It doesn't cost much money for that electricity. If there's natural gas being pumped in to keep this vehicle, this isn't like the command vehicle. I mean, in the county, it's got to be in a heated place all the time so it's ready. And if that's the case with the ambulance, then just figure out what those numbers are, just stick it in here, and then it's just a matter of how much a month. It's not per call, it's how much a month. Because if you only have one call, that's an expense because you've been heating that ambulance for one call in a month. But if you just figure out how much per year or whatever it's going to cost for the heat and the lights and things like that, stick it in there and divide, and then it's just a fixed number. You don't even divide it out because it's an expense, you know? I mean, we stuck capital replacement in there. If I hadn't stuck $12,000 in there for capital replacement, your costs would have shrunk by $12,000. Then you, and now you're in the real ball game here. Now you're really putting money in the bank. But it says, hey, you know, let's add $12,000 into it, and then we start out without stipends. And so for a year, we started out without $10,000 for stipends. We started out without capital, so that left us with supplies and cost of fuel, $2,800. Well, through adding these other things in, it got moved up to $2,400. But Nick, your questions are spot on. If I would challenge the board, be creative, find some more costs for us.
Well,
stick them in.
And again, I appreciate the question, but the important piece of this, and I'll reiterate it again, is that we already own an ambulance. It already goes on all of our medical calls. It's already in a heated garage. It's already plugged in. I mean, those are costs we already realize. Very similar to the question of liability insurance. We're already paying that. We already are realizing that cost today, and we did yesterday and the year before that. Those aren't new costs.
I wouldn't fight against the moving a percentage of the liability insurance, where you could say the percentage of this relates to our ambulance. But again, I think what you said is if you go to the insurance company and says we don't have an ambulance, your insurance is going to change. So if that's the case, then really insurance company is covering the ambulance when they don't need to, but they are. But if they have a checkbox that says we want to cover our ambulance, and then they say, oh, well, that's going to cost you another $1,000 a year. Now you've got a real number you can stick in here. And it's an annual number, so it goes down per call depending upon the more calls you have.
Yeah. And again, I'm just trying to differentiate with the board new cost versus cost we are already currently paying.
That's very important. JJ.
And I'm going to say the same thing differently. This board and this community decided a long, long time ago, like in the 80s, that one of the services the fire district would provide was emergency medical response. And there's a variety of reasons for that. One is that it takes a while for the ambulance to get out here, and when you're not breathing, waiting for that extra 5 minutes for the ambulance to arrive kind of sucks. The other piece is that ambulances are business models, and they send two people, and when you're really in trouble, or you weigh more than my wife, it takes more than two people to move you out. So there, this is to kind of reiterate what the chief said, that's a sunk cost. And it's a decision that this board and this community made 40 years ago to deliver that service. We're adding another little tiny piece onto that, and I don't mean to make light of that at all, but it's to actually drive you to the hospital and come back. So that's the, I would consider that personally as the heat, the lights, the garage bay. If we weren't doing EMS right now, I'd want to add that cost to it. But that's a pretty consistent, long-standing service that this organization has provided to the public. So I don't know the word that that belongs in with that.
My comment on that, Mr. Chair, JJ, is that if the ambulance were not there and you're paying for heat, lights, and X number of dollars per month for insurance and lights and heat and all of this, if it's like, we'll just say $500, and then you tell the insurance company we're gonna add an ambulance, you tell the power company we're gonna add an ambulance, if that drives the costs up, then now you can identify that it's associated with the ambulance. If it stays the same, then I agree that the district's paying that. It didn't change because of the ambulance. So maybe that's the litmus test that you use to determine whether or not that's an additional cost that it can be really attached to the ambulance. Personally, I'd like to see a little bit of the lights go towards the ambulance, but really, realistically, the ambulance didn't cost that. I mean, it's, the lights are there, the heat's there, the insulation's there, regardless of the ambulance is sitting in there. So that would be my litmus test.
And there's another cost there that we haven't discussed, and that's the cost of monitoring that. It's not a trivial cost to try to figure that out. I mean, we could come up with some sort of fractional percentage.
It'd be a fixed cost.
Yeah, and throw it in as a line, or we could throw 250 more bucks in it, right, in the capital replacement account to just say that's going to do
it's
it.
It's an annual cost.
Yeah, just but I think that the bright line for me is this. Is this a new cost that we're incurring, right, or is this business as usual?
I mean, you can take square footage and say, well, the ambulance is occupying right this amount of square footage. So it's kind of like you have an office in your home that the IRS lets you deduct that office. And then you could almost say, well, the ambulance is taking up space that is not cannot be taken up by a fire truck. So let's give that cubic footage cost, but how you come up with it. I don't know. I go both ways with it. I mean, it isn't a lot of money, but I mean, we had even more difficulty trying to figure out what the supplies cost on the average. Mm-hmm. And to me, $25 a run is pretty small.
Well, and again, those are new costs.
Yeah, those are
because we already use medical supplies, right, on our calls. And I think JJ said it best, that the only change is from the moment, instead of putting them into a third-party private ambulance, we're putting them into ours and driving them 5 miles to the hospital. I mean, we're already using medical supplies. We have oxygen. We have oxygen masks, bag valve masks, oral, nasal, pharyngeal, airways, all of that. And we have to use it and we have to replace it after calls. So much of that is, we already bear those costs, as JJ said, because however many years ago, this fire district decided that we would provide EMS service is just not the transport.
But now that you would charge, there's expectation that the district probably should not have to pay for those costs, and that's why we put the $25 per cost. So again, that is money that the district presently is paying as a gift to the community. And now, since you're taking on the extra commitments and giving the public the expectation that there's going to be an ambulance service, then it has to be treated as a real deal. I mean, you're charging. So if you're charging and you're not, it's not costing you any money, it's hard to justify that you should be charging. I think it's appropriate to, I mean, I was saying, hey, let's use a new defibrillator for every call. Hey, let's go there. That would ramp it up. If you're listening on the telephone, I was just kidding.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
It's just a very bad ex-commissioner joke. So.
Yeah, that's fine.
Any other questions?
We'll have more questions, I'm sure. Nick?
Well, to continue this a little bit more, and I agree that there's some things that are pretty small with electricity, but it does take a bay. There is maintenance on the vehicle. There is labor for maintenance. There's things related to this service, which is beyond the EMS service, which is board approved many, many years ago, the sourdough board, whoever started this. And all I'm trying to do is say the realistic cost of the transport part of the service really ought to be accounted for as accurately as possible in this per cost value. And to say that we already have the unit and there's no real other additional cost just doesn't seem, I guess I can't get my mind past that. But the other question I have is, so we have an EMS call, and I heard there's some difference between an EMS call and an auto call. What's the difference? If we send, there's an emergency and you're dispatched out, and our quick response unit, which happens to be an ambulance, which many of the other fire departments don't have, comes out and does their stabilize, stops the bleeding, whatever it is, uses stuff. Who, at what time and who makes the decision to turn that into a transport? Is that the incident commander? Is that the victim who, or his representative says, no, we're going to take him to hospital, or no, I want him to go home, and we're going to use our own vehicle? Who says we would have to do an HRFD transport? When does the user choose Highland Grove Fire District transport, not? And he used the word ambulance all the time. I want to make sure we talk about the transport side, which I think, in my mind at least, is completely separate. The transport may not be for an emergency. The emergency may be over. It may still be there, getting to the hospital as quick as possible, but it may not be. It may not be near. Maybe you just say, well, we're going to take somebody from point A to point B because grandma can't handle an oxygen tank, so we've got to get the ambulance to go take him over to the new home. I don't know those details. So help me understand, who makes the decision to make this into a transport after the emergency medical call is completed with our quick response unit, which is QR6, QU6?
I'm going to try, because I don't completely understand your question. But I will say that the patient is the one who decides whether he or she is going to be transported to the hospital. Okay. I mean, it's at the discretion of the patient, unless it's a minor, which then it falls under the category of, in law, of implied consent. So if we respond to a six-year-old who is without a parent or a legal guardian, and we believe that that six-year-old needs to be seen at a hospital, then through implied consent, we would take that patient to the hospital. But otherwise, it's completely, and that's the same with any ambulance service. We can't kidnap people. And if we take somebody against their will, who is thinking clearly and making, can answer all questions appropriately, which our medical control through the hospital dictates to us when a patient can and cannot consent to transport. But it is up to the patient to decide if he or she wants to be transported, whether it's a motor vehicle accident or a fire or a straight EMS call for a chest pain or a fall or whatever that may be. It's the patient's decision to be transported. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I got one last comment. Nick brings up an excellent question on maintenance and oil and all this kind of stuff. That is why in every setting, whether it's private business or government, that they have a especially with the state, county, federal, they have a federal mileage allowance, 54 cents a gallon, 54 cents a mile, or whatever. And if you multiply it out, it's always a lot greater than putting gas in your car. You can make some money on the deal. But the expectation of the government with that rate is that they're expecting you to include your maintenance in that amount, your oil, your gas, that you're not just buying gas.
And your insurance.
Insurance, everything attached to the car. So what we didn't know that night, we still don't know, how many miles are you going to drive? I mean, it's all random. I mean, there could be an accident out here. We just drive out to the road and pick somebody up and take them in, and that's 3 miles or 4 miles. Or you might have to drive a gateway or someplace. But if we knew an average number of miles per call, then you come up with an appropriate amount per mile, that answers the next question, I think. And I think that's appropriate to do it that way. Because then you can say, well, okay, there is, if we collect, X number of dollars per mile, or for the mileage, then a percentage of that would be dedicated to oil, or if you really want to break down that far. But that would cover for that. The idea is that for us not to fall behind on the costs of providing that service. So, but what happens if the engine blows it? I don't know. Does it come out of the 12 grand? Maybe. I don't know how that works. But that's responsible.
That could be a great refinement to your spreadsheet.
Absolutely. Anything you can add,
pick a number,
Right.
And the nice thing is when we get the new ambulance, it's got 00000 on it. And
right.
In 1 year, we have actuals.
Yeah. And so in a perfect world, you could just check with another ambulance district and have them provide you the numbers, but we've already just...
I just did the quick math, and on that state rate for mileage, if we looked at an additional 10 miles per call, given the transport versus what we already do in responding to the call, it roughly comes to be $550 a year in cost. So we could easily put that into the...
Yeah.
Thank you for letting me do this.
Thank you, Steve. Okay, is there any more board discussion before we get some public comment? Okay, any public comment?
Chief mentioned that the hospital keeps records when you do a transport. Is that correct? Point being that might give you a source for transport calls.
Yes, that the hospital has records of admissions into the hospital. I don't know that they would give them to us, because they're protected under HIPAA. And I think if we ask them, because we would have to go and go through those records and go through the addresses and try to figure out what those were, but that would include personal information. This is my knee-jerk reaction to having dealt with records at hospitals before. They're very, very sensitive to HIPAA laws and patient privacy. So it could be a challenging set of numbers to get from the hospital, but it's a great thought.
Next observation would be that I agree with Nick and Steve as well, that keeping track of the itemized costs for maintenance, storage facility, electricity, whatever, are something to consider. And I would bet that you would gain some information there by talking to your accountant on what they might suggest that you keep track of. I think that was the only one more. Capital replacement. Everything has a cost. The ambulance cost when you buy it, and it has a service life. It's a pretty simple calculation to figure out how much you need to save each year to pay for it. Thank you.
JJ, do you have something on your mind?
No. I
think that this is, thank you, Bob, for that. This is really important, this notion of new costs versus existing costs. And I think we really want to get clear on that. So as I've said before, if we're talking about new additional costs to the district, then clearly everything that folks have described about trying to track these costs is what we want to do. No question about that. Since it's a new program, it's in our interest to track those costs regardless. But I just want everyone to understand that this is not a new piece of equipment that's coming in additional to what we have. This has been scheduled for replacement. We have that capital replacement schedule, and it's just a straightforward mathematical calculation. And that's why we've put so much emphasis on building up these capital replacement funds, because as you've heard us say, while we're making progress, we're still behind. And things get really expensive when you get behind in fire department capital items. So am I saying that correctly, Chief, how to think about this? So we've got a vehicle, we're gonna swap vehicles, and the lights and the heat and that stuff is already being paid. And I get Steve White's distinction about not having the general fund cover these sorts of things. My approach, if I have a vote in it, would just be to kick 255, whatever the number is, into your capital replacement fund, or just create a separate line and call maintenance offset and pick a relatively reasonable number to do that. Because I think at the margins, those costs are not zero, but they approach that. One more comment I'd like to make is, I view this entire thing, this entire exercise that we're going in, as really our fundamental duty to the residents of this district to try to be looking out over the horizon a little bit and planning for something in the future. You've heard the problems that we've had with the private ambulance service. This has been a topic that has come up many times over the 20 odd years that I've been serving on fire department boards. It's not new. And what we want to do and what we are charged to do is to make sure that we're thinking far enough in advance that our residents are well served. Now, of course, we balance that with the tax obligations that all these things apply. From some of the emails I've gotten, people are under the misunderstanding that this is going to be a taxable, an increase to the property taxes of residents of the district. It's not. And they're also under the misimpression, I think, that this board can raise those taxes without a vote of the residents. We can't. And we get the best turnout at these meetings when there's a tax issue in front of us. People turn up, right? So this is a decision in my mind that is really an operational decision. That's why we're elected to make this decision. I don't anticipate we're gonna ask for a vote of the residents. That would be very expensive and set a very, very bad precedent. We never do that when we're asking, when we're making decisions about SCBAs or fire trucks or whatever. This is what we're elected to do, is to make these decisions. And again, I'll reiterate the direction I think we're going. I hope, Steve, you're willing to suffer through maybe a couple more meetings with refining this kind of stuff, is a series of information sessions, open houses, and try to get as many members of the public here that we can. I think Wayne Gibb's questions in particular were excellent. We should just include them in our FAQ sheet and work those down. Those FAQs are just an easy way to get people a lot of information very quickly and concisely. So I'd hope that our subcommittee is up for another couple of meetings, And then again, at the end of this meeting in October, I'd really like to schedule a couple of, you know, open houses, for lack of a better term. Steve, you got a comment?
Yeah, just a couple of comments, but I think, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to come back up. I want to reiterate what our discussion was that night when we were talking about this. What you're looking at here, I would hope, would if you do proceed with this ambulance idea, that this ultimately would prove to be the foundation of a budget document. And I believe that after, if you operated for 6 months or 12 months, that you would then have real numbers and that you could plug in here and it would become more of a realistic spreadsheet. And that this would be something that could just, like any budget thing, that would just continually be refined. And then ultimately, that when you do work with budgets for the beginning of your fiscal year, that you would have at least some ideas to the things to consider. And then also for the public, this is, I did this on Apple and the program numbers, which is, I sent it to Jason in Excel, and it's an open document, and anybody can mess with it if they want to. It's public, so it's not a PDF file. So.
Thanks, Steve. We'll have more public comment and board discussion. Let me ask you a question, Jason, in the negative. Let's say we get into this a year, and for whatever reason we're not liking it, and we decide not to do it. What does not doing it look like? What would change if we said, let's stop doing this?
It would look like today.
That's another thing that's really important for the public to understand, is that we are essentially already providing these services. We've had EMTs trained in this department for I don't know how long. We have all the equipment and supplies that Jason's already mentioned. Those are not new expenditures. Those are not expansion of services. In my mind, and this simplifies things, and I'm just going to simplify it for right now, but this model is, we have our troops already there in a vehicle, and the difference is, instead of packing up and coming home, we're packing up a person and taking a detour to the hospital and then coming home. Is that too much of an oversimplification?
It's a little bit of an oversimplification, but it's basically correct. I mean, we will be with that patient for five more minutes in the ambulance, and we do have the responsibility once we get to the hospital to give an accurate and complete patient report to the nurses on staff. So there is a slight change in that, but as I pointed out before, so many of our volunteers currently work for the private ambulance company and are very familiar with that. And it's not a reach to teach our current certified EMTs how to give a patient report at the hospital. So there is a little more. I don't want to undersell that to doing transport. But again, this is not something, you know, I am unfamiliar with. For those who don't know, I was the fire chief and worked for the Big Sky Fire Department for 15 years. And we did all the ambulance transport in Big Sky because there was no third-party ambulance to provide that service. So I'm very familiar with both working on an ambulance and administering to an ambulance service. And I do understand the cost of it, and I do understand the responsibility of doing that. And I don't take it lightly at all. And I also want to emphasize to the group that this is not what Central Valley did in their fire district. What Central Valley did in their fire district is they 100% took over all ambulance transport in their district. And that's not what I proposed to the Board of Trustees. I still want to remain in a partnership with AMR as we have in the past. What I'd like to do is to transport the lower acuity patients in our district, which, again, we can go into the hairy details of Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Echoes, and the way that those are established by our 911 center. But we would just take a portion of those, but AMR would still respond to some of our calls, and they would certainly be a backup to us. And are happy to be a backup because they do it for profit. They want to come to calls because they're providing that service for profit. And the other thing that, again, I want to reemphasize is that Our model here is based on charging our taxpayers roughly a quarter of what they would be charged for a transport with the private ambulance company. So not only do these numbers not represent any deficit in the operation of this, it represents a cost savings for every taxpayer in this district if they do require ambulance service. And we feel like between that and the preparation for the real possibility that AMR might not be here next year, it's very hard to stand up an ambulance service when you've never done it before. And what this allows us to do is take a baby step, if you will, in preparing to do ambulance service in the event that AMR leaves. Because there are a lot of fire districts in this county that are going to have absolutely no ambulance transport capability for their taxpayers if AMR were to leave. And to put this as bluntly as I can, AMR has no contract with the Gallatin County. They can leave tomorrow. They are not obligated in any way to give notice of the termination of services. When we have a call in our district and they don't have an ambulance available, do you know what happens? They just don't show up. They don't find another ambulance for us. They don't call us and say, I'm sorry, we didn't make that call. They just don't show up because they have no obligation as a private third-party ambulance service to actually get an ambulance to any of our calls. We do. We have an obligation as the fire district to provide adequate and standard EMS services to this community. And that's why we're talking about this today. So just wanted to clear a few of those.
Thank you, that's good information. Is there any more board discussion? JJ.
Average cost of a BLS transport from Highlight with AMR, Jason?
While they will not share those numbers with us, I would have to estimate $2,000.
Average tax bill for a resident that they pay for the Highlight Fire District every year, Mr. Chairman?
You're asking me if I know that? I have no idea. The average.
Okay. Everybody know? Hundreds of dollars, thousands of dollars?
Hundreds of dollars.
$200 for a house that's worth $400,000 or something.
Yeah.
Right. So if somebody from this district got an ambulance ride from the local fire department, they will have paid for their fire district taxes for a couple, 3 years. Yes?
In savings, yes.
More board discussion? Nick.
I guess going back to this separating the costs, in an original proposal that you did, Jason, it indicated that you would use the existing QRU-6 and add equipment and supplies to make it into a transport. That leads me to think that we don't just buy new ambulance to replace. I guess it's replace, not we're going to sell the old ambulance or give it to a poor district. We're going to have our new ambulance that should do the same function what we're already doing, because that's what we're authorized to do. What is the cost of that equipment and supplies? Should we not track the cost of what is chosen to be purchased in this ambulance if it goes above the strict replacing the EMS function, the emergency function? In other words, what part of the new ambulance were you referring to when you at that time indicated that we'd have to upgrade the existing ambulance to do transport service?
And before you answer, I just have a point of clarification. I thought the QRU was going to be a rehab, used for rehab, so like cascading flows, that kind of stuff, or did I misunderstand that?
That is to be determined. There's a number of things we could do with our existing QRU once we replace it. If we were going to replace it under our current capital replacement plan and not do transport, then I would probably recommend turning the old QRU into some type of rehab vehicle. If we were going to do transport, I would say we park it at Cottonwood and call that a reserve vehicle, very similar to what we do when we replace an engine. It's why we have four engines. We have three stations and four engines. We always have a reserve engine because there are always repairs that have to happen with engines. So, now Nick, your question was, what would we need to do to upgrade the old QRU? Now, is that if we do transport with a new unit in under this proposed plan?
My understanding was that we would upgrade QRU6 for transport service. And I didn't know what that cost would be. I didn't know what equipment, because it mentioned supplies and equipment. So what is it? I don't know. I mean, is it a defibrillator? Is it a bigger oxygen tank? I don't know what it is. The changes, according to what you, if I understood you were to propose to do, you would upgrade this thing for transport purposes. So I'm saying that now if we're going to get a new ambulance to replace the one we have, what are we going to do in that to upgrade that to make it into a good transport ambulance? Is there something you buy more? Is it going to take a bigger chassis? Is it going to take a bigger box? Is it going to take a softer bed? I don't know what it is that you need to differentiate upgrading the unit for transport.
Okay, I'm a little confused if you're talking about the old unit or the new unit.
Yeah,
what's going to happen to the old unit? Is it going to be used for transport? And if so, what are those costs? Are there any costs entailed in that, getting that ready for transport?
That's not what you're asking, Nick. Yes, you're not.
What I'm asking is let's just forget the new ambulance.
Yeah.
We were going to upgrade the old one for transport purposes. At least that was a possible proposal. True. Bullet number two in your original proposal said we would upgrade the existing QUR6 for transport. And so my question was, what does that mean? What piece of equipment? What cost is there related to that? What do you do to upgrade? If we were going to upgrade it, what would that be?
So, I'm going to try to answer your question because I'm still a little confused. If we were going to do transport now and do it the way this plan provides, and we weren't buying a new one, if we were just going to use the old one to do it, I would want to buy a new cot for it because our current cot is not a powered cot and it does represent potential back injuries for our EMTs. Almost every ambulance service now uses a battery-powered cot that lifts on its own so people aren't bending over and picking up. Now, if we're buying a new ambulance, the cost estimates that I gave to you guys for that included that power cot. I wouldn't suggest if we were just going to use that old QRU as a backup. If the new ambulance needs to go to the shop, we pull the power cot out of it, we put in the old one, and we're good to go. So the upgrade would only have been if the old QRU was going to be our primary transport unit.
So what you're saying then is that if we were replacing what we existing now with something new, but we were not going to transport, we would put in the better ergonomic device that would not hurt our volunteers or people, but load of people. That would probably be the natural standard codes and standard upgrade. Is there anything else that you would have to put in ordering that ambulance that you would get because you're saying, oh, we're going to use it for transport?
No.
Could have to have faster windshield wipers, you're going to have more lights. I don't know what these might be. I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah. So let me say again, Nick, we already do transport. We already do transport. So if we were to replace the QRU, it would have to be ready for transport. There's nothing, if we were doing this plan versus replacing that vehicle, we've done a transport this month. We do transport already because AMR doesn't have units available. So no, there's no upgrade in replacing this current unit doing transport as this plan suggests, or keeping our current status as we respond today. No difference.
Okay. So the current transport that we're doing is just the first three letters. We're not doing...
No, we're doing everything. When there's not an ambulance available, we're it. Because there's nobody else, Nick. We're it.
So is there special equipment for D&E? Do you have to have special for severity level? Because you're saying in this plan, we're not going to do D&E unless forced to because AMR is gone. But if AMR stays forever, then we're really just... We're just doing what you're saying you're doing already. We're not doing any D&E.
No, we are currently, because when there's not an ambulance available from AMR, they don't decide to send us based on the call type. We just have to transport. It doesn't matter if it's an Alpha or an Echo. We're still doing the transport because we're the only game in town at that.
But only at the request.
There's no request. There's no request.
I thought you said the patient had to decide when they want to transfer.
Well, of course. It still makes us the only game in town. There is no other ambulance. It's us. Okay. And that's the reality of where we are today, is because AMR cannot provide an ambulance for every 911 call that occurs in this county, we are already doing transports.
Okay, let me just interrupt for a second, if I may. That this conversation is no doubt helpful to members of the public who are listening. But, Nick, I know you've reached out to Jason, which I think is excellent, the right thing to do. Maybe you should just consider joining that committee, too, so you can get some of your questions answered, in a slower time than a board meeting. So just something to think about.
If I were invited, probably I would.
Well, you...
Yeah. So my neighbor didn't invite me.
Well, you get to take that up with your neighbor.
anybody can come.
Yeah,
truly.
You have my seat.
Yeah.
Now you're stuck. Sorry.
Okay. Are there more other board members with questions? We can keep this moving along. Is there any public comment on what you've heard? Okay, so let's move to next steps. I've outlined a couple of times what I think we ought to do. What do you guys think we ought to do? And we'll pick dates at the end of the meeting. We don't have to do that right now. So the general flow I'm suggesting is in October, we'll have a regular board meeting. We could cancel the regular board meeting. We could have three special meetings. We could have two special meetings and a regular board meeting. What would you guys like to do? Trustees, that question is directed to you.
Jason says drive on. What do we need to do to finish any numbers and either say yes or no, but we got to get going. We're already doing the transports.
Right. So I think having the opportunity to have at least one open house, whatever you want to call it, and we could do that in September if you want to do that. As long as it's properly noticed, I think that is a step to getting to decision making. I think the logistics of what that looks like is I'd like that subcommittee to meet one more time. I think that Wayne Gibb has sent some excellent questions there that we ought to include in our FAQ sheet. We prepare those. Those are just Word documents. They're not particularly tricky. We've got Steve's spreadsheet with whatever updates they want to make, and we have an open house. That's how I would like to proceed. How does that sound, everybody?
I think that it's important that we have us complete a proposal document, a business plan with as good a data as we put together that we're satisfied with, ready for the people. Then at that point, we make every effort. There's mainly postcards for all registered voters or whatever, and get it on the web, and make sure they understand it's on the web, et cetera, so that the public has plenty of time to have a look at that, and then, yes, have that meeting. And
well, just looking at the count, I agree with you, Nick. I should listen a lot and not do I'm sure we can't go down to the county clerk and ask them to do mailing for us right now. That ain't going to happen.
I'm sorry, I really don't understand how that works.
It requires the assistance to mail everything to the residents of the county, and I'm sure with the election coming up, they're not in that. But let me just tell you what I'm thinking here. Today's the 15th. We got two more weeks left in September. We are going to rely on you, Jason, speaking for the committee, to when you think you have all the information that you need in a format that's good to go. But we could, for example, on the 29th, hold an open house on this issue. And we could get the signboard out there. We could get Dave Kraft to put a couple hay bales there and get a sign made at Signs R Us. And then we'd have, you know, another 2 weeks before the regular board meeting on the 20th of October. And depending on what we heard, we could do another meeting on October 6th. But, you know, I think that if I'm with JJ, we're moving this towards, I think it's irresponsible to punt it to November. We got almost a month before the next board meeting in October. That's plenty of time to get information out to the public. I'll be happy to pen an op-ed in the paper if that's helpful. Just to spread the word, but it seems to me like we ought to make a decision on this on the 20th of October. How does that sound to you guys for a timeline?
Sounds great.
Jason, does it sound like by the 29th you could have what you need to host a public meeting where basically we're going to be making presentations?
Well, Pat and Steve, how are your schedules looking? Could we meet on the 23rd? JJ? No, JJ's out for that whole week. Are you back the following week?
Well, and individual people shouldn't hold this process up. JJ can send you comments that are written or leave you a voicemail or whatever.
Well, could we meet on the 30th, Wednesday the 30th? It's good. JJ?
You're going to have to deal with Mary Fran.
I will. I will.
Okay, so then if you're thinking about having another meeting
and then October 6th.
And then October 6th, we do the first public outreach?
Yep.
Okay. And then we're still tracking on, you know, we'll see what we hear then, and we can decide on the 20th, we can make a decision on the 20th. Does that sound good? And if we hear, you know, we have 250 people showing up on the 6th, maybe we'll have another meeting. But I'd like to keep the 20th as our, you know, date to make a decision pending information that I don't anticipate. And Pat and Steve, having you guys at that public meeting, I think it'd be really important not only to thank you for your service, but to let people know that you guys have played a big role in this. That'd be really good.
October 6th is bad.
Okay, so does that sound like a plan? So I hear, Jason, that you guys are going to try to meet on the 30th. We are going to announce a special public meeting on October 6th to make a presentation to the community regarding our ambulance transportation proposal. That sound good? And then we can talk about whether we're going to have cake and cookies and that kind of stuff. And, you know, maybe with the COVID provisions, Jason, we just plan to do it in the bays. We roll some trucks out so we have a little bigger space for people to spread out, something like that.
Yeah, that would be easy.
Yeah. How's that sound, everybody?
Sounds great.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Fire Chief Support, any questions for the Chief regarding his report?
The 6th at 7?
The 6th at 7.
So the only thing that I'm going to skip my chief's report. You guys can read it. If you have questions, let me know.
Hang on one sec before we just blow through that. Any board comments on the chief report? Any public comment on the chief's report? Okay, Jason, thanks.
Our pancake breakfast we had scheduled out months ago to be October 3rd. However, with COVID, that definitely put some challenges in front of us. So I met with the health department numerous times, and we wrote a pretty extensive pancake breakfast plan for them. And to put it as briefly as I can, this would be a completely different pancake breakfast than what people are used to.
But we still would have pancakes.
There would still be pancakes and bacon and eggs and all that stuff. But basically, the only way I could sell the health department on it is if we maintained 8-foot spacing between our tables. We only sat people who came as a group or a family at one table, and we did table-side service. So we would basically be going up to the tables and taking orders and then going getting food for people. Because what we're trying to do is avoid any standing in line through food service or getting in the door. We would also create a staging area in our parking spot out here in the wheat field. And that would, we would basically, people would wait in their cars. And then when there was a table available, we'd bring them in to do that. So it's going to be a little different. No fire truck rides, no bounce house. But we would still be able to host a pancake breakfast for our citizens.
And a great opportunity to alert people to the meeting 2-3 days later.
That's correct. Yeah. So I propose that we do it. I wanted the board's blessing on that. I have the health department's blessing, but I would like yours. Again, given that it's a modified pancake breakfast, different than what we
have. But there will be pancakes.
But there shall be pancakes.
That's not getting modified.
Correct.
What do you think? Any concerns?
Sounds good to me.
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
We decide if you want to have the FAQs out there or just flyers saying, hey, show up on the 6th, whatever, we can figure that out.
Yeah, I think we could make a big bulletin board.
Yeah, perfect.
And have information to hand out to people and even staff it. I know Steve would be more than willing to actually be there to staff that table and
Steve, don't you have a chef's mock with your name on it?
I want to do it virtually, and I want to kiss the babies.
Any public comment on the modified pancake?
I'm an ex-product tester. So.
Yeah. I know we're keeping you away from small children.
Yeah.
Trustee activities. Any trustee activities? Any announcements? So we're set for the next regular meeting to be that third Tuesday in October, which I have as the 20th, unless I got that wrong. And again, a reminder, we got pancake breakfast on the 3rd, opportunity to promote the special meeting on the 6th regarding the ambulance service. Any comments from the telephone? Anybody on the telephone? Okay, meeting's adjourned.